Welcome, everyone. Welcome to the Yahoo Fantasy Football Forecast. I'm Scott Pianowski, and I want to jump right into our guest today, who is Davis Maddock. I was just telling him right before we started, this guy's got so many good takes and so many good angles and so many good strategies. I'm almost reluctant to share them because I know they're going to be used against me in my leagues. It's going to cut down my EV a little bit, but hopefully it will help yours. Mr. Maddock, how are you?
You know, I'm doing great. We are in the thick of draft season. I think I've done about 15 drafts the last 2 days, just been grinding them out. I think it's one of those things where football season is kind of, you know, sneaking up on all of us because we didn't know if it was going to happen or not. And, you know, we're really making up for lost time, getting as many drafts in as we can.
Yeah, we are definitely in the middle of draft season. For me, it's best ball early. That's how I get the feel of the draft pool and how I, you know, where the nooks and crannies are, the ebb and flow. And then I want to apply that to my seasonal leagues. And then, of course, in season, we'll be playing DFS. And let's just start with an idea of stacking. We were recently in a best ball draft together, and you were able to get a Kansas City stack, very juicy Kansas City stack, and a very juicy Dallas stack in there. And I started to think about stacking. We know stacking is a DFS strategy, and we know stacking can be a best ball strategy. Does stacking apply to seasonal? How do you feel about stacking in general? Do people, what are some of the do's and don'ts of stacking? I say stacking to you. What do you say?
So I think that there is kind of this misconception that like you don't need to do it or it's not really all that important. But I think the number one thing that I would just tell people about stacking is think of all the start sit decisions you've gotten wrong in your life. Like, oh, I played this wide receiver three over this wide receiver three and the other wide receiver three that I put on my bench, you know, the Lee Evans corollary, right? Four targets, four catches, 120 yards and a touchdown. And, you know, and you started Jeremy Maclin and he had two catches for 17 yards and did nothing. So the number one thing that stacking in weekly management leagues is going to do for you is just going to take those decisions out of your hand. If you have Matthew Stafford and you have TJ Hawkinson and Marvin Jones, you're not going to debate on starting those guys. And the weeks where you go off, the correlated, like the good Matthew Stafford weeks, you're going to have these huge, great lineups. And the weeks where Matt Stafford does poorly, he's going to do poorly anyway. And, you know, that's going to affect your team anyway. So I think the easiest way in fantasy sports to score more points, and this is true across hockey and soccer and baseball, it is just to correlate your decision points. And that's why I think we need to be stacking in every format.
And I think most people would agree if we were to rank all the fantasy offenses, I think Kansas City would have to be first. And then there's a debate, maybe Baltimore would be second. Dallas is high up on that list. How explosive do you think this Dallas offense is? Do you think they're buying opportunities here? Are they priced up properly? Just give me a sense of how you view this Dallas team.
I think other than Zeke, everyone's actually too cheap. I think that Amari Cooper should go ahead of Kenny Golladay and Mike Evans. He goes after them in pretty much every fantasy game. I think that Michael Gallup should go in the DJ Shark, Tyler Lockett tier. And it's starting to get that way because, you know, we have that iron sharpens iron thing of, you know, now we're getting millions of drafts being done across the country every single day. But for a long time this offseason, you could get Michael Gallup in the seventh or eighth round. You know, in the offense that led the NFL in yards overall. So I think that he's too cheap. And then Lamb, I think, has a great opportunity because if you just look at the Dallas wide receiver depth chart, after those top three guys, you go, well, who is going to stop Lamb from starting week one? Is it Cedric Wilson? Probably not. You know, is it, you know, Tavon Austin, not even on the team anymore? Well, then the argument would be, well, is he even going to see the field? And their backup tight end is Dalton Schultz. Rico Gather's not on the team anymore. So their base personnel from week one is just going to be Cooper, Gallup, Lamb, Jarwin, Zeke. And, you know, maybe we get some more Tony Pollard this year. But I think across the board, everyone is either priced appropriately where you can draft them and break even or massively profit all the way down to Jarwin.
Do you view Dak as the number three quarterback?
Yeah, I have him. I have him there. And the reason why I have him ahead of Kyler is play calling concerns. Like Dallas, I don't think is going to struggle to be aggressive this year the way they were under Jason Garrett. And also, I think there is a slight concern that Hopkins is not A-plus Hopkins his first year in Arizona. You know, just that history of elite free agent wide receivers switching teams, oftentimes they take a year in the new team to rebound in form. And that's, you know, with preseason games, with full contact practices. And now we don't have either of those things.
Yeah, Hopkins has certainly been one of my fades for that reason. I don't think I'm going to have any of him. And he's obviously a wonderful player, and I think eventually he'll be great in Arizona, but I don't want to bet on him this year. When we mentioned Lamb, I know this can be a little bit too convenient that people can say, oh, well, it's, you know, it's a totally unique year and there's just no prep time. How can we trust these rookie receivers? We just saw a very strong rookie receiver class. I think the second best in the fantasy era, the 2014 class, probably stands above everybody else. But last year, a bunch of young receivers, pretty much everybody but N'Keal Harry, by my memory, seemed to go off at one point or another. How do we handle really good receiver class came in? A lot of talented guys, a lot of Alabama guys, a lot of first round guys, but it's 2020. How do we handle the rookie receiver class?
I am basically jamming these guys in at ADP. The one who's gotten expensive is Jalen Reagor, where he now goes, like he sometimes goes as early as the eighth round in competitive leagues. And I like Reagor, but I think that instead Henry Ruggs, Jerry Jeudy, CeeDee Lamb, LaVisca Chenault, you can get all these guys at appropriate prices, and they may not start the year as fantasy starters, right? You may not be comfortable plugging LaVisca Chenault in week two, but I think all these guys are pretty great prospects. We had a ton of guys go in the first and second round of the NFL draft, which just generally correlates to playing time. And, I was talking to a buddy last night, and I kind of forgot that A.J. Brown actually was not a fantasy starter for the beginning of the year. You know, everyone remembers A.J. Brown just crushing it and scoring a 60-yard touchdown every game. But he was playing behind Adam Humphries, Tajae Sharpe, and Corey Davis for really the first half of the season for Tennessee. And I think that's very indicative of what we expect from Ruggs, from Jeudy, from Reagor. Well, Reagor probably starts week one, but I'm not sure if he's, you know, rocket ship from week one. But especially Chenault is, I think those guys can be league winning guys over the second half of the year.
I almost wonder if maybe my personal path might be that a lot of these guys, maybe I won't draft them, but I'll be very eager to pick them up when somebody gets tired of them in week four, or week five, bye weeks come in, they have more immediate needs. I got some Mike Evans in 2014 just because somebody got hurt. He missed a couple of games. Somebody couldn't afford to hold him, and I lucked into the timing of that. I mean, you know, be lucky with timing isn't really a repeatable strategy, but, I'm going to point to it anyway. Just to put a period on the stacking discussion, look, we all know stack Kansas City. You know, I think Baltimore's got a reasonable stack argument. We talked about how Dallas could be a very stackable team. Who were maybe some of the secondary stacks or just like a under the radar stack that's interesting to you? I know I'm going to have some Chark and Minshew somewhere just because I think it's just going to be a really fun kind of carnival atmosphere in Jacksonville. And I've been, you know, trashing Leonard Fournette kind of daily. It got a little bit messy yesterday. We'll talk about him a little bit later. But any under the radar teams or just maybe underserved stacking teams that you see right now?
Well, I think a really important thing to note is it's okay to do like the backdoor stack, especially in best ball where, you know, it's like Ryan Tannehill, Corey Davis, Jonnu Smith or whatever. But then also the other important thing you should be thinking is the higher you draft your tight end, the higher you draft your wide receiver, the better that stack is going to be because you're making the correlated bet that, you know, not only is your second round wide receiver going to hit, but then that their quarterback probably beats their expectation. So Kenny Galladay, Matt Stafford is, I think, is pretty solid. And Stafford was playing the best football of his career last year for 8 weeks before he got injured. And a really sneaky one that I don't think that is popular at all is Tyler Higbee and Jared Goff. And I view those as mega correlated. I think there's no way that Higbee beats ADP without Goff returning to kind of that 2018 form. And I think there is no way that Higbee gets there if the Rams are bad, right? If the, you know, the continued dissension of the Sean McVay apple falling from the tree or the shine coming off the apple with Sean McVay, like I think those guys are hyper correlated. And that's one that I use a lot in these best ball drafts.
It's interesting you mentioned Higbee because I feel like he's a debated guy in the fantasy industry. I know a lot of people are in on Higbee. I'm in on him. Michael Salfino's in on Higbee. I know some people who think, you know, look, he was behind Gerald Everett before this whole thing happened in December. I think some people are maybe there's a little bit of McVay fatigue because, that offense wasn't that shiny. To me, I think McVay is evolving and they went to a different offense. And when a guy has four straight 100-yard games at the tight end position, I know a couple of juicy matchups in there, and obviously Everett being off the field helped. But if you see the routes that they were running Everett and the ways they were getting him the ball, really easy catches and very creative usage, I feel like that's a genie that's out of the bottle, and McVay's not putting it back in.
So I started out the offseason being pretty out on Tyler Higbee. And then, you know, a couple things really got me back into it. First off is, you know, I don't know if they're going to throw the ball to their running backs that much, which is something they did in 2017 and 2018 and then didn't do at all last year, which I think is partly an explanatory variable for why Higbee was not good for his first, you know, not good for fantasy his first couple years in LA, and then had that opportunity arise. And then also, I've kind of been a long term, like, Josh Reynolds is a good sort of guy, but he's really not. Like, I just kind of looking more into Josh Reynolds, very low yards per target relative to the offense. You know, really his best role is kind of near the red zone, but that's probably mostly fluky. And then also for all of Higbee's career, not just those insane, you know, that insane five game stretch last year, he was a very high targets per route run guy. That is a stat discovered from our friend Pat Corain from Establish the Run. Just that even before he was putting up amazing fantasy numbers, when he was on the field and running routes, he was targeted at a really high rate, which would suggest, you know, either he's very good at creating separation or Jared Goff just likes to throw to him the type of routes that he runs. So I think that's pretty big.
Yeah, I'm definitely on the Higbee train too. It's kind of a little bit of a shame, maybe not so much with Higbee, but you talked about how the ADPs are starting to get more efficient now. And that's one reason why I love best ball drafting early. And I love drafting. I don't draft before the NFL draft. That's just a little bit too chaotic and random for me. But once the NFL draft is in ink, I love those 2 or 3 months where the ADPs are kind of wide open, and I feel they're only going to get more and more efficient the rest of the month. So I feel like, you know, get in now while there's still really good opportunity to be had.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I mean, I think that the May, June, July drafts are, you know, some of the most profitable ones that you can do, basically. You know, I think that we don't have all of this external pressure. We don't have a ton of training camp updates. And if you get ahead on some, you know, kind of small news items like, oh, you know, Jerick McKinnon is healthy and the 49ers plan to use him as their third down, or if you realize something that the market doesn't realize as much, like, oh, Josh Jacobs is not going to catch any passes. They re-signed Jalen Richard. They draft Lynn Bowden Jr. Like, and those are things that the public realizes by September 1st, where Josh Jacobs has slowly been creeping out of the first round back towards, you know, the second round, where is more appropriate for him. And just if you are kind of putting the work in early on, you will figure those things out.
Totally agree. I get frustrated when there's an early injury and some people will jump up and down and say, oh, that's why we get a draft in September 1st, man. You know, you can't be drafted in June. But look, football and injuries are just, you never get away from that. I mean, there's going to be a ton of injuries when the season starts. And I feel like what you gain in that fresh powder that's just been put down, rather than once tracks start getting made and stuff becomes more obvious and becomes shared and then things totally change. I think it's worth it. And even if somebody doesn't agree that it's maybe plus EV, which is fine, if nothing else, if you do all the early drafts, you're going to get so familiar with the positional pool. And I think there's a lot of payoff there. We get to jump into running backs. We can't talk 45 minutes on running backs. And we had a running back preview last week with Andy Behrens. That was terrific. So I encourage everybody to go back with that. But running back's the most important position in fantasy, as far as you have to have that position figured out, or you have to run good in running back, or you're just not going to have a good year. I don't care how many hits you get at other positions. If your running backs don't work out, you're probably not going to have a good season. And your draft strategy piece on Sports Grid talked about your strategy for running backs this year, and you made it very simple. You said modified zero RB or die. So that's five words. Explain what that means, and let's talk running backs a little bit.
So if I was going to extend it a couple more words, it would be don't draft bad running backs just because they're eligible at the running back position. Don't take a player that you think is going to score fewer points than a wide receiver or a tight end just because you can put those points in at running back, especially because it is becoming more and more popular for home leagues to add, you know, multiple flex spots. As every flex spots get added, wide receivers become more valuable and running backs become less valuable. You know, Christian McCaffrey, if you can start 12 players, sure, the team with Christian McCaffrey should still probably be favored, but every additional roster spot is worth more and more. And drafters, in regardless of format, regardless of scoring, just always let good wide receivers go too long. You know, people are drafting guys like Todd Gurley, Leonard Fournette, Le'Veon Bell, Chris Carson, just these guys with massive warts over DJ Shark, over Cortland Sutton, over Terry McLaurin. Like the list just goes on and on. And it can also be said pretty simply by, this is probably going to be the weirdest year ever in terms of guys missing games, you know, guys not playing. And the example that I've been using with people is, if Mike Thomas misses a game, who benefits? Well, you know, Kamara probably gets a couple extra targets. Jared Cook probably takes a slightly bigger role. Maybe move Manny Sanders from wide receiver 42 on the week to wide receiver 35. Maybe Traquan Smith is startable in a 16-team league. But there's no real clear beneficiary. If Ezekiel Elliott ends up on the COVID list for 3 weeks, Tony Pollard might score the most points in fantasy football over those 3 weeks. If Alvin Kamara misses, Latavius Murray might score the most fantasy points over those 3 weeks. If Dalvin Cook misses, you know, and the list goes on. And there are kind of five or six running backs who are clear, contingent value guys. But it's very easy to see why that is the correct strategy this year, I think.
Now, when you say modified zero RB, for those who may not know exactly what that is, just give a definition for that.
So what you said about running backs being most important, everything I just said, it's still true that like having this crazy good running back is really valuable. And basically what it means is, if you have one of those top 5, 6, 7, 8 picks, and that's kind of controversial for some people, you still are taking a running back. You're not taking Michael Thomas over McCaffrey. You're not taking him over Saquon Barkley, Ezekiel Elliott, Alvin Kamara, Dalvin Cook. And then for me, I have Miles Sanders and Clyde Edwards-Helaire in that group. You know, I will take Clyde Edwards-Helaire at 7. I'll take Miles Sanders at 8. And that is where the list ends for me. So Derrick Henry, not in there for me, though I won't strenuously object to it. But then the guys who I would just be like, you're probably losing value taking these guys over Michael Thomas, is Joe Mixon, Nick Chubb, Josh Jacobs, Kenyon Drake. I think that those guys are second-round picks for sure.
Drake's interesting to me because, look, 8-game sample in Arizona, he was the running back 4 in PPR the moment he hit down. And I know it's the air raid offense, but it's a really good running offense. And they might, I would think, as they get closer to being a competitive team, maybe you have more positive game scripts than they had last year. But he has such a small sample of being productive. Obviously, he wasn't a starter in college, which I can kind of overlook, or a full-time guy in college. I can overlook that when you go to Alabama and there's just so many great athletes that it's hard to have that backfield to yourself. But are you going to have any Drake this year? I feel like he's kind of a in or out player for a lot of people. Are you firmly out on Drake?
No, not at all. Another key thing is that early running backs are more valuable in best ball, especially the best ball championships. You know, on a lot of these sites, they have the championships where you play in a 12-man league, but the goal really is to win the overall contest, right? And something that you run into is zero RB tends to be very good against fragile teams over 16 weeks, but you move that time frame to 12 weeks to make the playoffs. You know, you move that time frame to 10 weeks to get to the first in your league. Those running backs that are going to score points in the first month of the season, the first 6 weeks of the season, tend to be more valuable just because it puts your team in position to win the league and make the playoffs. So Kenyon Drake, probably not a guy that I am pressing the button on all that often, you know, like taking DJ Moore there a lot, taking Chris Godwin there, Julio Jones. But in best ball, where you can't make waiver moves, right? You can't. So if Dalvin Cook gets hurt, you can't go pick up Mike Boone speculatively. You have your 18 or 20 guys and you're just riding out from there. So I'm more likely to take him in best ball for sure.
One thing I like about modified zero RB, I wrote an article a few years ago where I called it Anchors Away. I wasn't able to brand it very well, and nobody knows what I'm talking about when I say that. But just the idea that I got this solid running back in the first round that I really feel good about, and then I could start pounding other positions, and I'll kind of ham and egg it at the RB2, RB3 spots. But one reason why I've always liked that is then you don't shop in the third or fourth or fifth round for running backs, which I think can just be a terrible place to shop. Ben Gretsch put a really good piece out about the dead zone. I forget exactly what he phrased that. I think he meant to call it the dead zone or something like that.
Yeah, and, the running back dead zone.
Right, and you're going to run. This is where you're going to run into Leonard Fournette. You're going to run into Todd Gurley. I know they're the two of my biggest fades this year. I believe they're on your fade list as well. What's your take on running backs in that pocket, and specifically, why don't we like Fournette or Gurley?
So, I mean, it's just very obvious to see psychologically what happens with those guys. You look at Gurley, you look at Fournette, you look at Melvin Gordon, and you go like, oh, well, these guys are starting running backs. Like, they're just going to get 200 carries. They're going to get some targets. They're going to get some touchdowns. And you psychologically look at your roster and you go, well, I got to fill the starting lineup. I got to have a team that looks pretty when this is all done, right? So you just, like, the lizard brain drafters are just like, all right, Todd Gurley, let's do it. Chris Carson, let's do it. David Johnson, let's do it. And, you know, specifically for Fournette, the team tried to trade him. The people that drafted him are out of the building. His protector from the second administration that he played under in Jacksonville, Tom Coughlin, he also left. Jay Gruden has never had his leading rusher. This is insane. He's been in the league for almost a decade. And every team he's coached, the guy who led the team in rushing attempts has never had more than 26 targets. And in fact, the guy who led his backfield in targets for each of the last three seasons, Chris Thompson, signed on the roster. But then also, Rykel Armstead was bad and inefficient as a runner when he came in to spell Fournette last year, but was efficient as a pass catcher, you know, was mostly fine catching those dump offs from Gardner Minshew. So I basically just think that there's like 100 times you play this season out, Fournette pays his tag off like 10% of the time.
Yeah, I was getting into it with some of the Fournette people on the weekend, and somebody was pointing to how easy Jacksonville's rushing schedule was. And my counter to that is, look, they're projected to be, by win total, I think the worst team in the NFL. So how could you possibly have a lot of positive game script if you're a 4-12, 5-11, 3-13 team, which I think is what they're squarely looking at here. Really interested in Minshew and Chark, but all the things you pointed to, they tried to, not only tried to trade Fournette, they got zero offers. They couldn't give the guy away. And he's in a lame duck contract situation. He's probably not coming back.
I even think
there's a less than 0% chance he doesn't make the roster. I'm not saying it's going to happen.
Just get cut, right.
I don't think that's completely, you know, I think there's a chance of that. If I could get down on that at a pretty good number, I think I'd put something down on it. So, you know, with the new OC, with all the stuff you mentioned with Thompson, I think you're hitting a lot of the right spots there, checking a lot of the right boxes. What I point to with Gurley is that I have a theory I called the cheese theory, which is that once the cheese goes bad on a player and he's on the back nine of his career, I think it's a mistake to proactively expect that he's going to have a rebound. Not that this can never happen, but I look at Gurley, you know, people say, oh, he's only 26. He's going to be the oldest 26-year-old in the league with all the knee problems and blowouts he's had at Georgia and in the NFL. And now he goes from a team. Obviously, the Rams had offensive line problems last year. The Falcons, I think, are going to be a really poor offensive line. You know, offensive lines to me are like, I want to know who the really great ones are and who the really awful ones are. And there's like 17 or 18 offensive lines that I just don't care about because they're good enough. They're capable enough. They can scheme around it if they have to. But I just feel like Gurley is, people may not realize that it's closer to the end for Gurley than it is from the beginning. And even though he had a strong fantasy year last year, just strictly because of the touchdown deodorant, that's great. If you can fall in the end zone 14 times, I would never project that for him. But all of his efficiency numbers were through the floor. Now, if somebody's going to say to me, well, what if he went in the sixth round? Okay, look, if anybody drops crazy below their ADP, I'll reevaluate on the fly. I mean, you have to be that type of player in the room. But if he's going around his ADP, I could not be more out on Todd Gurley. What say you?
Yeah, no interest. You know, the injury concerns, the team, you know, the Rams couldn't throw him the ball anymore because he couldn't cut up the field. You know, went from 80 plus targets 2 years in a row to 49 targets in 15 games last year. And you look at him and like, well, yeah, you can't throw the ball to this guy because he can't cut laterally. He can really only go in one direction. I think that a lot of what people are drafting him are is actually based on this kind of fragile idea that he won't lose any snaps to Brian Hill or Ito Smith. But he's a guy where if he loses third downs at all to Ito Smith, it's just like a disaster. Like it is just because Atlanta does throw to their running backs, but you're basically thinking like, oh, well, they have to throw to their running backs and it has to be to Todd Gurley or it's just a huge mess.
If we're not in on Gurley, I know you mentioned Julio earlier, is Atlanta a fun, maybe carnival team with Ryan? I talked about carnivals last week. Ryan, Julio, Maybe Calvin Ridley has a step-up season. Ridley's interesting because he's been so ballyhooed in the community. The price just keeps rising on him. He's another guy. The inefficient market a few months ago gave you Ridley opportunity you really can't get right now. Just give me a quick hit on that Atlanta passing game.
Yeah, so I don't think very much of Hayden Hurst. I know they traded the second-round pick for him, but I think that, you know, targets do kind of tend to be an indicator of quality, unlike carries, where carries are just given because offenses feel the need to run the ball regardless of who's healthy or who the running back is. So if you think that, you know, Sanu's gone, replaced by Russell Gage, maybe Olamide Zaccheaus plays there, you know, maybe Justin Hardy plays, whatever. We think there's a running back probably that's not going to earn a huge target share. I think there is kind of one of those seasons where we have, you know, 1,400 yards from Julio Jones, 1,100 yards from Calvin Ridley, and like 60% of the team's total targets goes to those two guys. I actually think that's in the range of outcomes. And I think talking about stacking Julio in the second, Calvin Ridley in the third, Matt Ryan in the eighth is like a really interesting one, both for weekly management and for best ball.
Very, very gettable too. Ryan's one of my favorite guys because when I see somebody who's consistently productive but so boring that you never have to pay a premium for him, that's, I don't know, there's something like that in the middle of a draft. I'm not saying I want to draft like that at the front because you need your early picks should excite you. If the first couple of guys you've drafted aren't exciting to you, you have really done it wrong. But Matt Ryan is a comfortable fallback for me in 2020. Now, a lot of people are saying it's a really deep wide receiver season, and you don't agree with that. You think it's actually much the opposite. Why don't you explain that? And let's talk some receivers.
Well, people say that because they can tell themselves stories about guys all the way into like the 14th round, right? They're like, oh, you know, I'm starting Julian Edelman and Brandon Cooks and Anthony Miller. And they're like, well, those are all starting wide receivers. Those guys are all going to have good weeks. And the first thing that does is that tells you that you are going to pick the right weeks to start guys. Right, that you are good at predicting what weeks guys are going to score points and that you're going to get your start sit decisions right. Like the huge equity in taking Mike Evans, Chris Godwin, DJ Moore, DJ Shark is that these guys are just going to start them every week. You're never going to worry about sitting them for matchup concerns or whatever, and they are going to pay off that tag. Whereas and also spending waiver wire dollars on wide receivers is like just a loss so often. You know, how many times, we all have the Lee Evans, the Devery Henderson, DeMarcus Robinson, I guess is kind of the new age version of that. Like, you know, four targets, two touchdowns, guy played 50% of the snaps, you spend some fab dollars on him, and, you know, you never start him, and then you end up cutting him back. Whereas at running back, you know if you're going to play a guy 1 week or not, right? So starter gets injured, you pick up the backup, you spend your fab dollars and you use them and you feel good about that stability. And I think that wide receiver it's just not deep at all. If you look at projected points, really there's a huge drop off kind of after Tyler Lockett and Cortland Sutton, where it's then all guys who project for like kind of like less than 12 points a game. And yeah, it's just not very deep at all.
Yeah, this goes back to the idea of modified zero RB, where I love the idea. If you have a lineup where you have that stud running back you're playing every week, and then you have, say, your league starts three receivers, if you know who those three guys are every week and they're strong, they're the unbenchable types, you're never benching Adam Thielen, okay? That's what you want. And as far as a running back too, I mean, you can get so much of running backs is just the usage, and that's pretty projectable. If we know somebody's going to get double-digit touches as a running back, they're probably going to have a certain amount of value. And if they have some of those touches are in the passing game, even more so because they're more valuable. It's a leap of faith just to know any receiver is going to get targets. And even if it gets targeted, they could be for naught. You could be targeted eight times and have 27 yards, no touchdown. And then that's a loss for you. So I like people. I always feel better about my rosters. I know after five or six rounds, if I'm already kind of ahead of other people in receiver, but I have a running back I can hang my hat on, I feel like those are the strongest rosters by the end of the draft.
Yeah, I mean, you think about setting your lineup for week one, and you're like, okay, I have my CMC, Barkley, Zeke, Kamara, whoever, you know, my stud, my anchor, and then I have three wide receivers who I don't even know who they play week one, and I don't even care because they're just going to be starting, and they're going to score a lot of points, and I'm going to feel great about it. And then you just kind of work with what you got at running back too. You know, I mean, we're still a month away Some running back is going to tear their ACL at training camp. Someone's gonna have a hamstring, and I'm not rooting for that. I'm never rooting for these guys to get hurt. As the originator of zero running back, kind of concept in the original writer Sean Siegel, as he said, karmically, he's not rooting for anyone to get injured, and he doesn't actually want anyone, but he just wants to deal with the math of the game that we play.
Right. That's the whole point, is that, yeah, we're not rooting for chaos. We just know chaos is coming, and let's find strategies that benefit from chaos. And we know the NFL is obviously a huge injury sport. There's more uncertainty this year with all the health concerns that aren't even tied specifically to injury. So we need strategies that will work well when things get really chaotic. I want to get a piece of fantasy football wisdom from you. A lot of times when I see strategy pieces and the mistakes that managers make, a lot of times it's just one-on-one stuff like, oh, you got to know your rules really, really well, or don't take a defense in round 7, don't pay up for last year's stats. I think people know that. What's maybe a secondary thing as far as fantasy football strategy or wisdom that you can offer our listeners?
Building your team structurally correct is actually like more important than getting your player projections correct. So, we get really bogged down in, oh, well, I really like this player, but really it's just kind of more important to know, like, historically running backs from round 3 to 5 are bad bets, and tight ends from round 6 to 10 are bad bets. So you kind of just want, I think it's just very important to know historically what has got, like, what happens with players at given positions. And with running backs, you see guys get pushed up because people look at round 6 through 10 and they're like, well, I don't like any of those running backs. I don't want to start any of them. And actually, probably the best rule is whatever you draft, it's like by like week 10, you're going to have like 4 of those players left on your team. Guys right. are going to get hurt. You're going to trade. You're going to be grinding the waiver wire. It's very rare for the team you draft to be the core of what you're starting in week 12.
It's a great point. I like to say, and I'll use this as my wisdom, you play fantasy football with a microscope more than a telescope. And when people say to me in July or August, oh, look at this guy I'm going to get. His week 15, 16 schedule is awesome. How do you even know? One, he'll be healthy then. Two, the opponents will be as bad as you think or as juicy as you think by then. So many things are going to change. And especially with defenses, right? I mean, we know that there's more year over year stickiness with offenses. Defenses have a lot more variance. That's one reason why the Patriots are a defense I would never draft. I don't care where they figured last year. I think this year they're like an 8-8, 9-7 team. It's a very ordinary squad. And you're just not going to have all those games where they're ahead by 20 points in the fourth quarter. And it's really a good spot for the defense maybe to pick up some garbage scoring. So I think the most important thing is just to get off to a good start. If you want to look at schedules, look at early schedules, look at the stuff we know, and we'll figure out the lay of the land in the second half of the season. That's also when I'm more likely to be invested in some of these backup running backs, these insurance running backs, guys who don't have standalone value, but could be really exciting if the starter in front of them got hurt. I want to play for the big inning in the summer. And I'm not saying I would never take one of these running backs who fits that profile, but I'm really interested in that in the middle of the season. I think that time to get involved in that type of player is halfway through the year. We know more definition of the depth chart. Maybe I don't need some of the depth that I needed early in the year with buys. Maybe that's out the window. And now I can play, the way I compare it a lot of times is in baseball, right? Bunting in the first inning can almost never be right. But bunting might be right in the 9th or 10th inning when one run wins the game. It might make sense once the path to winning is very specific. But I just hate to see anybody bunting in the summer.
Yeah. Okay. That actually reminds me of another one that, and this mm-hmm. sounds like very trite, but people don't do it. Don't draft a kicker or a defense if the season is a month sure. away. Draft 2 extra running backs and, you can cut them, like, whatever. Draft Darrell Williams for the Chiefs, right? Like, so he has no value now, but if, God forbid, something happens to Clyde Edwards-Helaire in training camp, Darrell Williams is going in the 8th round, right? Something happens to Josh Jacobs, Lynn Bowden Jr. is going in the 8th round. Something happens to Leonard Fournette, Michael Armstead's probably just going where Leonard Fournette is going. Like, I don't see any reason why you'd want to lock up, in your 12-team home league with your buddies. Like, why would you keep a defense slot when you could be trying to hit the home run?
That's a great piece of strategy. And right now is the time to employ it. Give yourself 3 or 4 weeks to get lucky with a piece of news. Now, the corollary to this is that if you're drafting right before the season, when you are going to draft a defense and a kicker, just look at week one or week two. And you don't, I don't care what you think of them long term. Just get the cheapest defense that you would want to play in week one. That's fine with me. None of this, you're not going to have, with very rare exception, you're going to have like one or two primary defenses all year. It just doesn't work that way. That's going to be the position. And we know with kicker and defense, they're very significantly tied to, you want to have a winning team. You want to have a team that ultimately wins the game. And whenever anybody asks me a start sit question on a defense, and one team is like on a 5-point favorite, one team's on an underdog, I'm like, I don't even care about anything else. You don't have to go into any deep analysis here. You're taking the defense on the team that's favored.
Yeah, I mean, that's just, again, one of the things where we know historically over 50 years of NFL games, like, just home favorites are just, you just play a home favorite defense and don't really sweat anything else. And for you to keep a defense all year, it's got to be kind of one of those like historic runs, like the Chicago Bears that year where they scored like 15 touchdowns or something insane, or the Patriots last year, and which is just totally random, really.
Right. And even the Patriots, it kind of ran out, that bubble burst in the final third of the season. But yeah, if it's not a historic defense, you're not carrying them through bye weeks and stuff like that. We're getting fantasy advice from Davis Maddock, one of my best friends in the industry, and just a great follow on Twitter, Davis Maddock. At the end of the podcast, we'll talk about some of his projects and we can get more of his work, including a cheat sheet, which is so detailed and yet easy to understand that it's just a monster resource to have. You print this thing out and you'll have basically Davis, you know, tapping you on the shoulder and guiding you every round if you would like that, which I think is a really good idea. We just saw Washington. There's been some shakeup in their backfield. Darius Geis is off the team for obvious reasons. Adrian Peterson looks like their first two-down grinder, but he's a million years old. Gibson's ADP is kind of jumping up. What's your take on him? Are you going to be invested this year? What do you think about this backfield?
Well, you know, another reason to get those drafts in early. Gibson, one of my most drafted players of the offseason, because you could just for a while you could get him free. Like, he was going in like the 17th round. Then he kind of started to creep up as what Scott Turner called him, Christian McCaffrey light or something like that. Like, the team started to talk about him, and now he goes really early. Like, you are kind of lucky to get him in the 8th round now. And I mean, for the most part, I do kind of think that it's appropriate because, you know, kind of after the top 60 or so players, we're just talking about really wide ranges of outcomes. You know, these are guys who can get benched. These are guys who can just not be very good anymore. So I'm very fine taking shots there. And I think that actually kind of the way that Gibson gets there, I think it's unrealistic in year one for him to go from being like an offensive weapon style player at Memphis to being a 300 carry running back. But Washington has this really terrible wide receiver depth chart. So, you know, they have McLaurin and they have Sims, and then they just have a bunch of guys who are very average to below average. And it's actually underrated. They don't really have a tight end either. They have Logan Thomas, who is, you know, fine. Hale Hentges, Jeremy Sprinkle, but these are not guys who demand playing time or targets. So I actually think kind of the way that you end up with a winning running back selection out of Gibson is they give him, do you remember when Sean Green and LaDainian Tomlinson played together in New York? And Sean Green was getting 18 carries a game, but they were all the terrible carries. They were all second and eight up the gut. And then LaDainian Tomlinson was getting like 6 carries a game, but it was all the good carries. It was the goal line carries. It was third and three, you know, the pitch to the outside, the speed option. Like, he was getting all the good carries. And so I think Gibson can do that better than Peterson can, obviously. But then also there's no reason why he can't do what he did in college, which was just be a slot wide receiver and do both of those things. And I think that's actually the Gibson upside case, is that they give him some carries, but he's getting loads of work as a pass catcher.
Just because we mentioned Washington, just give me a really quick hit on this. Terry McLaurin just seems like a darling. I don't know anybody who has anything negative to say about McLaurin, and I'll tie in Marquise Brown into this in a second. But what's your take on McLaurin this year?
I really like him. I take him after Sutton, which I think is kind of controversial. I think a lot of people like McLaurin more than Sutton, but Sutton is just such an alpha, and I think that I'm sort of taking the way that Denver structured their offseason to mean they saw what Kansas City is doing and they realized they're never going to be the best team in the division if they're giving 40 carries a game to Philip Lindsay and Royce Freeman. I think that the Melvin Gordon signing actually shifts towards more pass heavy, because Melvin Gordon is not a very good running back, but he is has generally been efficient as a pass catcher and is good around the goal line. They draft Drew Lock's college teammate, Albert O, who he threw 14 touchdowns to his final season at Missouri. They draft KJ Hamler. They draft Noah Fant and Jerry Jeudy in the first round in back-to-back years. I think they are basically telling us, we want to try and be like Kansas City. We want to try and score 28 points a game. And you don't do that by feeding Philip Lindsay carries on second and five. So I just think that the Denver prices might actually be really wrong in the market if Drew Lock is good. Now, if Drew Lock is bad, you know, all bets are off. You know, who knows what happens, and they go back into that shell. But if Drew Lock does kind of deliver on that promise that the organization sees in him, I think all other guys are underpriced just down the board.
I know Fant and Hockenson, two of the second-year tight ends, are guys you're drafting a lot. Now, I'm going to say this. Fant is going to be a fantasy stud at some point really soon. I can't guarantee it's this year, but so many times he'd make a play last year, and I would just write it to him. Please, Noah Fant next year. Have a lot of this guy. Now, it turns out there's a lot of tight ends I want to have. I feel like that 9 to 15 tight end area, and even going a little deeper, Jarwin's interesting. Herndon's interesting. We talked earlier about Higbee, who's a little bit more expensive, but he's interesting. There's a lot of tight ends I want to get, but I just know that at one point people are going to be really glad they have Noah Fant. I don't know if it's this year or not, but although I do have some Fant, and I know you've invested as well. Some of your targets, you have players clearly marked as targets and fades in a piece that you did on Sports Grid. And one of the guys you have mentioned here is Marquise Brown. And I made a joke on Twitter a couple days ago that, you know, basically everybody in the FSWA has to do a Marcus Brown puff piece. You're a buzz piece. Not that your piece should be read. Not that people don't have good things to say about Brown, but I feel like everybody likes him. I think there's one writer I saw who did a piece on Brown, and then I saw his consensus ranking of Brown was actually below the market. Not that I want to pick on that. Sometimes our rankings don't always reflect how we feel, and we have to kind of update that stuff or whatever. I'm not trying to play gotcha. I'm just wondering, how can we make money on Marquise Brown if it feels like everybody is clamoring to get on that bus?
Well, the way you make money on Marquise Brown is you draft him where you take Lamar Jackson. So maybe you play in dynasty leagues where you were lucky enough to get Lamar Jackson, you know, way below what his current value is. Maybe it falls to you in your draft where you lock up a stud running back in round one, a stud wide receiver in round two, and you're really going for the home run and you want to take Lamar Jackson. And also, a great way to do that, I think, is you start Saquon Barkley, you take DJ Moore at the end of the second round, and then Lamar's sitting there for you at, the 302, and you take Lamar, and then, you go with, oftentimes it's going to be like Sharp or Lockett there at the end of the fourth, and then you can start the fifth round with Marquise Brown, and that's definitely above market for him. But those bets are so correlated because Lamar, to pay off his tag this year and to be a league winning player, not only does he have to run again, but they're going to have to be in more high volume passing situations. They're going to have to play more competitive games. And we actually saw that in the playoff game where they fell behind. And when they fell behind, they stopped playing around, right? It was, we have to get points on every single possession, no matter what. And when they did that, Mark Ingram was not on the field. It was Justice Hill every snap. And Justice Hill was either running routes or pass blocking and creating space for Lamar. They were throwing the ball deep down the field. And, I'm not here to relitigate, can Lamar make it? Is he a good quarterback? Whatever. I'm not interested. I think he's great. I think the Ravens are going to score a ton of points. But the more that they are in those game situations, the higher and higher the ceiling for Marquise Brown goes. So for Brown to get there, you actually are rooting for the Ravens to kind of be a worse team relative to league average.
Once that game became obvious that the Titans were going to win it, it was actually really fun to watch the Ravens play in the second half. And Jackson had a ton of pseudo garbage time. They kind of made the game cosmetically close. Jackson, if you played fantasy in the playoffs, man, I know in the Salfino contest, I didn't play the Baltimore quarterback that week, and I got killed because Jackson just put up this monstrous score, and it was fun. And Brown, of course, well over 100 yards, had a touchdown in that game. So you could see some of what might be possible this year when they need to play a little bit different. We have only about a minute left. Some of the fades that are mentioned on your Sports Grid article, Leonard Fournette, we talked about a lot, Le'Veon Bell, Emmanuel Sanders, Julian Edelman, a lot of back nine players, I would say, on that list. Just pick one of those guys and maybe in 30 seconds tell us why they're a fade.
So Edelman is the one that I think surprises people because he's been so stable for so long. Basically, I think he's a bad stylistic fit for Cam Newton. I think every year a guy goes past 30, the more likely the cliff is there, and no one saw the cliff, including that player. And I actually, if you gave me kind of decent odds, I would take N'Keal Harry straight up out targeting Julian Edelman as a first round guy who just was hurt last year, but was targeted more than you remember in their playoff game. So that's kind of it with Edelman.
Yeah, Harry makes a lot of sense as a post type guy because they need him to play. I mean, there's no upside for Sanu. Edelman into an age 34 season. Remember, so much of what Edelman did well was being on the same page with Brady. That's out the window. I don't know how much time he's going to have to get synced up with Cam. I just think New England's in a lot of ways a bad fit, but I see the case for Harry. I think he's an interesting investment. Davis Maddock has been our guest today on the Yahoo Fantasy Football Forecast on Twitter. Davis Maddock, DavisMattek. Davis, tell our listeners what else you're working on this year.
All my fantasy content is free. My rankings, my projections, my articles on sportsgrid.com. I do a weekly, actually in the season, more often, three or four times a week, the Sports Grid Fantasy Football Podcast. And then I host a more conversational lifestyle, you know, gambling fantasy style show called The Take Cast. And you can find all of those things if you just Google my name or search it in wherever you listen to podcasts.
Good stuff. And if you are a podcast guy, remember, I do host the Yahoo Fantasy Baseball Podcast. We're coming at you with five of these Yahoo Fantasy Football Forecast podcasts, both preseason and in season. Please download the Yahoo NFL podcast. We have a great college sports podcast on Yahoo with Wetzel 40 and Thamel. Those guys are great. So a lot of ways to serve you in the podcast space. For our guest, Davis Maddock, who was great today, for my producer, Raghu, who's keeping us on the air and sounding great, I'm Scott Pianowski. Andy Barron's coming at you tomorrow, and I'll be back with baseball on Monday. So a lot to talk about. Sports are coming back. Glad you're with us. We will talk to you soon.
It's no secret that our world has been interrupted. A World Interrupted is a daily podcast telling stories of coronavirus and its impact on the economy. We want to cover the issues in the macro, global economics, the stock market, and our political climate. We'll also cover the micro stories, maybe the ones you don't hear as much about in the news or the media. We hope you'll listen and be a part of the journey. So subscribe today on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts.